Why do an estimated 40 million Americans suffer from an anxiety disorder in any given year? Why do more women than men have anxiety disorders? Why are the rates of anxiety disorders in young people on the rise? What's it like to live with anxiety? And what's new when it comes to treatment? We will explore all of these questions this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We will talk with a health writer about her personal experiences with anxiety and look at the effects of this condition that is often stigmatized and explore the future of treatment and welcome your questions and maybe even your own personal experiences. What is it like to live with anxiety? How has anxiety affected your life or maybe the life of someone you know? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Andrea Peterson, contributing writer at the Wall Street Journal, where she reports on psychology, health, and neuroscience. And she is also the author of On the Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. Good morning, and thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joy. I really appreciate it.
Well, first off, what exactly is an anxiety disorder?
Now, anxiety is a normal human emotion. We all have it, and to a certain amount of anxiety is actually a good thing. It can help us and motivate us to study for tests, to prepare for retirement. But when it becomes a disorder is when it impairs people's lives, when it affects you from doing the things you want to do when you want to do it. And there are 11 different anxiety disorders that are actually listed in the DSM, which is sort of the diagnostic bible for mental health professionals. Everything from generalized anxiety disorder, which is characterized by uncontrollable and impairing worry, to panic disorder, which is my kind of primary anxiety disorder, which is characterized by intense periods of distressing physical symptoms like a racing heart, shortness of breath, and a feeling like you're going to die. These are panic attacks, and they can come from out of nowhere. To social anxiety disorder, which is a deep fear of social interactions. People with social anxiety disorder often have a hard time mingling at parties or developing close friendships. And to post-traumatic stress disorder, which probably a lot of people are familiar with, which can happen after a particular trauma.
Yeah, and so, and we'll talk more about many of these different types of anxiety disorders, but just to clarify, those of us who might be feeling particularly anxious or worried or concerned because of things going on in our personal life or things going on in the country with a crisis after crisis in the news. Feeling anxiety over that is different than necessarily having an anxiety disorder.
Right. I mean, when it becomes a disorder is really when it prevents you from living your life the way you want to. So that really is kind of the distinction between sort of normal anxiety that we all feel because of things going on in our personal life or things going on in the world, and when it actually becomes a disorder and really warrants treatment.
Yeah. So does the anxiety going on in the world trigger people who have anxiety disorders?
Definitely. I mean, one of the things that the anxious brain has a hard time with is uncertainty. And, intolerance of uncertainty is actually something that a lot of people with anxiety struggle with. And so, I mean, I think no matter what your politics, I think we can all probably agree that this is definitely an uncertain time.
Yeah. And each year, 40 million American adults have one of the different anxiety disorders any given year.
That's right. That's right.
And
you
write,
it's actually more prevalent than depression and mood disorders. It's the most prevalent sort of type of mental health issue.
Yeah, you also write that this doesn't include the millions of garden variety worriers and insomniacs whose anxiety steals their peace of mind, but that it's really a significant amount of people. What is the broader effect of anxiety on us and our society?
Well, anxiety, in and of itself, it can be very miserable, but it also is increasingly, researchers are increasingly seeing anxiety disorder anxiety disorders as actually a gateway illness. They can lead to all sorts of other negative outcomes, such as they can lead to depression, they can lead to substance abuse, they can derail lives. People with anxiety disorders are less likely to go to college. If they're working, they are paid less. They're less likely to marry, and if they do marry, they're more likely to divorce. So there are consequences of anxiety, wide consequences of it. Also, anxiety disorders can be lethal. While we think, we often think of as a depression as being most closely linked with suicide. Actually, depression is most closely linked with suicidal thoughts, but it's actually anxiety disorders and other disorders like impulse disorders and substance abuse disorders that are actually mostly closely tied to suicidal acts. So anxiety can actually be deadly.
So do we know why we're seeing an increase in the diagnosis of people with anxiety disorders, in particular young people, college students?
That's actually one of the questions I really try to answer in my book, On Edge, because there is this uptick in the rates of anxiety disorders among young people, particularly college students. And, no one knows exactly for sure why that is. There's a lot of speculation. I mean, some people point to the rising rates of tuition at college and the burden of loans. Students are taking out greater and greater loans to pay for college, to economic uncertainty, to even certain styles of parenting, the so-called helicopter parenting, where parents have a difficult time allowing their kids to fail, is thought to fuel anxiety too. I mean, another element is, though, and this is a good thing, is that stigma does seem to be decreasing, particularly on college campuses and among young people. There's just more awareness about mental health issues. College counseling centers are much more visible on campus and welcoming places, and kids are encouraged to seek treatment. There's really a robust advocacy, mental health advocacy groups, student-led advocacy groups on campuses nowadays. So professionals also speculate that some of the rising rates are just because more students are actually feel comfortable asking for help.
We are talking with Andrea Peterson, author of On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. We welcome your questions and your own stories at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Andrea, you talk about your own situation with anxiety in the book. You said earlier that it was panic attacks that you dealt with. What was that like?
Oh, I was actually diagnosed finally in college, but anxiety, I actually can point to a particular moment when anxiety really became, it pretty much took over my life. I was a sophomore in college at the University of Michigan, and it was a normal day, an average day, and I was actually registering for classes. And this was pre-web days, so there was actually a wall filled with printer paper that were and written down on it was the classes that were open for the next semester. And, I felt fine. And then a second later, I didn't. My heart rate kicked up. I broke out in a thin film of sweat. I started breathing incredibly rapidly. I had strange visual changes. All of a sudden, there was these gray blotches in front of my eyes, and the words in front of me started dipping and buckling. And I was seized by this absolute terror that I was going to die, that something in my body had just gone irrevocably wrong. And a panic attack actually is supposed to peak within about 10 minutes and then subside, but for about 4 weeks, I felt like I was having almost a continual panic attack. I mean, yes, there were peaks and valleys to that, but it was, I ended up actually marooned on my parents' sofa, and pretty much didn't move from it except to, consult a doctor, who didn't find anything wrong with me except for mitral valve prolapse, which is a leaky heart valve, mm-hmm. which is usually benign. And that actually started a kind of a medical odyssey that I went on for the next year. It took me about a year to be diagnosed appropriately. I saw probably a dozen doctors, had all sorts of tests, blood tests, EKGs, echocardiograms, an MRI of my brain. Doctors speculated that I might have multiple sclerosis or Epstein-Barr virus or chronic fatigue syndrome. It wasn't until I finally ended up in a psychiatrist's office and she said, I can put you on Prozac or I can send you to the anxiety disorders program at University of Michigan Hospital. And that was the first time someone had mentioned the word anxiety to me.
So what causes an anxiety disorder, do we know?
There's so many. There's no smoking guns. I mean, it's really multifactorial. I mean, everything from genetics, first of all, about 30 to 40% of the individual differences in anxiety are related to genes. If you have a immediate family member that has an anxiety disorder, your likelihood of having one is 5 times that of the general population. So genetics certainly play a role. Also, things like trauma in childhood, respiratory illnesses in childhood, certain temperaments are actually more prone to anxiety disorders. Temperaments that can be seen, that can be identified in children as, in babies, actually, as young as 4 months old. There's something called a high reactive temperament, which is, there's a whole series of tests that you can give to an infant to assess how they react to novelty. And, infants that react to novelty, they kind of thrash their arms, they get really distressed by novelty, often grow up into being inhibited, what's called behaviorally inhibited preschoolers, where they're, just very shy and socially reticent. And those children have a much higher likelihood of developing anxiety disorder, in particular social anxiety disorder. Mm. So there's really, I can point to, if you have a phobia, actually, as a young child, that's also a risk factor for developing anxiety disorders. I had a clown phobia as a little kid.
What kind of phobia?
Clown phobia, I know is not a particularly novel one. I think a lot of kids are freaked out by clowns. But there was a Sesame Street segment in the late 70s that showed a clown putting his makeup on, and then they ran the tape backwards, and so to me, I thought it looked like he was taking his face off. And anyway, it was so terrifying.
Yeah.
It was very freaky, and so I would literally, I love Sesame Street, but I would literally watch it with 1 foot out the door. And if I as soon as I saw that clown on there, I would come like running and screaming out of the room.
How interesting. You also note, and it's a fact, that more women have anxiety disorders than men. So why is that?
That's right. I mean, the numbers are actually pretty shocking. About 40% of women will have one or more anxiety disorders at some point during their life. And again, the reason for that is not totally clear. Scientists aren't sure. There's some evidence that actually hormonal factors may contribute. Fluctuating estrogen levels might fuel some of the anxiety that women feel. But a lot of scientists also look at the way girls are raised versus the way boys are raised. There's a series of very fascinating studies actually done out of Canada for a woman who researches actually the difference in injury rates among boys and girls. Boys are much more likely to be injured than girls are after age 2, and their injuries tend to be much more serious. And this woman was noticing on the playground, boys are much more likely to be encouraged to be independent, or girls are much more likely to be encouraged to be cautioned about safety. And the speculation is that those messages, which we're telling girls to always be careful, and she actually has a study where watched parents on the playground teaching their children how to slide down like a firehouse pole and also play on various playground equipment. And parents of girls were much more likely to physically help their girls, even when the girls didn't ask for it, whereas when they would not do that with boys. They're much more likely to encourage boys to play independently. And even if boys asked for help, they would say no, and they would tell the boys to do it themselves. So the message that can send to girls is the world's a dangerous place. You're not able to cope on your own. And that is, that sort of beliefs can fuel anxiety.
We are talking about anxiety and talking about living with an anxiety disorder, talking about what causes, what cures, or at least what is done to treat anxiety. We'll get into that next. And we are welcoming your questions and your own experiences. Do you also live with anxiety? What's it like for you? Do you know someone who does? How does that affect you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Don't be shy. We have an open line for you. Let's talk about anxiety and what can be done to lessen then that anxiety. Our guest is Andrea Peterson, author of On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with Andrea Peterson. She is a contributing writer at the Wall Street Journal, where she reports on health and psychology and neuroscience. And she is the author of a book that is in part about her own experience with anxiety, On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety, talking about how it affected her life and how it affects the lives of tens of millions of Americans. Some 40 million Americans suffer from anxiety disorders every year. The rate of diagnoses in college students is on the rise. More women than men have anxiety disorders. We're talking about why that might be. And we will talk more about what is new in terms of treatment. And we will welcome your questions and your stories at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And our lines are full, so let's go to the phones. Bob in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I've suffered from anxiety for a good 25 years intensely, and I went through various therapies, including drug therapy of Celexa and talk therapy, and what I found out was eventually, and this is fairly rare, I had a tumor that was pressing on my pituitary gland, and as a result of that tumor pressing on my pituitary gland, my adrenals were out of whack, and my cortisone and testosterone were not producing. And so really that was the core of the anxiety that I suffered from for 20 years. And I'm telling you, you know, as the guest is talking about, I mean, suicidal thoughts are come regularly to a person who, at least for me, it's very, very, very difficult. And I don't think people understand the disorder, and certainly in my case, medically, with it's called hypopituitarism, this tumor on my pituitary gland, which, wow. Again, is,
How dare, Bob, I take it that tumor has been removed and things are different now?
Yes, it was removed, and then it started to come back, so then I had radiation to remove it, which to excise it to make sure it doesn't continue to grow after it was manually removed. And depressed about that because my pituitary will probably never work again. Well, it probably will not work again because of the radiation on this this tumor.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry for all that. But Bob, how did your anxiety manifest?
Well, I'm a teacher, and I'd be panicked every day in class. I'd want to flee from class. In meetings, I'd want to flee. I couldn't be there because it was just too much. It was overwhelming. But of course, I had to be there. So I've had a very successful career, teaching career, but I just had to bite the bullet and get through it.
Yeah. So wanting to flee every situation, Andrea.
Yes. I mean, the car brings up a good point, though, that it is important for people to see a primary care doctor, if they start having new symptoms, because, anxiety can mimic other physical conditions. It can actually co-occur with some physical conditions, you know, medical conditions, and it can also exacerbate some too. It's definitely always good to make sure you have a good relationship with a primary care doctor as well.
Bob, thank you for sharing your story. That's quite the journey for you too. Andrea, what I was going to ask you, you were experiencing panic attacks in college, and after your own odyssey of getting, you know, seeing various specialists, finally got the diagnosis that you had anxiety disorder. Did you then go through this regime of, I don't know, Bob said talk therapy and drug therapy and other therapies?
I went through, I started cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the most evidence-based non-drug treatment for anxiety disorders, and it usually involves about 12 to 15 sessions with a therapist, and the real workhorse of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT as it's called, is exposure therapy. And what that means is you gradually and systematically expose yourself to the things you're afraid of. Now, what happens often in panic disorder in particular is that, say I had a panic attack when I was standing in line at a coffee shop. Well, pretty soon, you know, I would avoid coffee shops. I'd avoid standing in line. You know, I avoided going to movies. Basically, unless my world actually became smaller and smaller. So part of exposure therapy was, you know, having to, you know, to make myself stand in lines, you know, to make myself go to the movies. Also, because one of my big fears was that, you know, I would get very scared when my heart rate kicked up. And I would be worried that I was going to have a heart attack. And so I actually, my therapist, as for homework, I had to run up a flight of stairs and actually welcome those symptoms. And what exposure therapy does is basically by disproving, you know, I ran up the stairs and I didn't drop dead. And I kept doing it and I kept not dropping dead. And so soon enough, that evidence kind of overrode the fear, and the fear started to dissipate.
What about clowns?
I'm still freaked out about clowns. They're just creepy.
Yeah. You were afraid of driving on highways, touching a new tube of toothpaste?
Yes. I'm sorry. That's my one Achilles heel. That's one thing I still don't do is drive on highways.
And it's interesting, too, because I know some people who are afraid to drive on highways. I don't know for a fact that they have an anxiety disorder. Can you have a fear or a phobia and not necessarily have an anxiety disorder?
Well, I mean, what matters is if it impairs your life in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you have a phobia of snakes and you live in New York City, you know,
that's true.
It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if you have a phobia of driving on highways and you live in Los Angeles,
that's hard.
You know. It might be a real problem. I mean, now there's Uber and you know, a Lyft and other ride sharing services, so people can probably get around. You know, but it depends on how much it's interfering with your life. Is it whether it rises to a disorder?
Saeed in Brookfield is with us. Hi, Saeed.
Yes. Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guest. Reason I called, I noticed that we're talking about some serious cases here, and you know. Extreme, but at the same time, since this is about educating the public, I just want to share my experience that I went through some very light anxiety, even though everything was going good in my life and in our family life and all. But, you know, just worrying about everyday life and, you know, where you're going to be next day and the next day. And I think as a result, I kind of like started dealing with some depression, worrying too much and all. And, I was one of those people, it can't be me, it can't be me. There's no way I'll get over this. It's just a phase. And this really lasted about a couple of years and taking I think, unnecessary toll and stress on my family, putting up with that. And once I started seeing psychiatrists, and actually, I heard somewhere that you said it's good to talk to your physician, but I honestly think it's best to, if you're feeling any of these symptoms, see a psychiatrist rather than a physician, because they're too generalist to help you out. But once I started seeing a psychiatrist and started taking a medication, I truly started seeing a difference within the first week. And I think I'm not back to 100%, but I can say I'm definitely better than 90% of where I was to normal function and all that.
Thank you for sharing that story and, I guess, giving some hope. Andrea, reaction?
I wanted to ask the caller, what kind of treatment did you seek? What worked for you?
Actually, what I did, I mean, you're seeing, I have two kids, two boys, and we had some issues with raising them, one being a teenager, mm-hmm. not in college. And younger one, we had some issues. He was a special, neat kid and all that. We started doing family counseling altogether, marriage counseling. And then, you know, I started seeing a psychiatrist for my own, anxiety and / depression. And I started taking medication.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah, and the medication, if it's okay to share the name, it's Wellbutrin, I think very, very common. And since then, I've even suggested that to a few friends to really go for it. And one of them did, and is a psychiatrist, and he started having some talk about that and asked for this particular medication. And I call it the magic medication. He told me he started seeing results after a few days, too.
Yeah. Now, thank you, Saeed, for that. So that's the drug therapy. And I'm just curious. Saeed was saying that he had anxiety/depression. Are they related? Are they connected usually?
Yes, they are often connected. They often go hand in hand. Comorbidity between anxiety and depression is incredibly common. And also, anxiety can often be a precursor to a bout of depression, mm-hmm. too. So yes. And the thing is, I mean, the drug therapy that tends to work for both. I mentioned CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, but the other main evidence-based treatment for anxiety disorders is our SSRI medications like Zoloft and Paxil and Prozac. Those medications, in many studies, they're shown to be at least modestly effective for anxiety disorders. I finally went on medication in my late 20s when I was having a relapse, and you know, I knew I was very motivated because I knew I had a job that I loved. I was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. I had a new boyfriend. It was a relationship that I was very excited about, and I knew I didn't want to go back onto my parents' sofa for 4 weeks. I had been afraid to take medication. First I tried Zoloft, and that actually had terrible side effects for me. You might have to try several medications before you find one that works. Unfortunately, about a third of people with anxiety disorders don't respond to medication. And only about half of people who do a course of CBT get clinically significant improvement. So we clearly do need new treatments, and there is exciting new research that there are new treatments on the horizon. And I think that's great news for people who may not get full relief or relief at all from the current treatments available.
And what are these new treatments? Do we know what these new treatments are?
They range. Some of the things are actually really simple that could be implemented right away. And there's some researchers that are looking at how to improve cognitive behavioral therapy, improve the efficacy of it. And things like there's research showing that actually having your therapy appointment in the morning can actually enhance the efficacy of it.
Hmm.
Also, taking a nap afterward, that actually consolidates the learning that you've gleaned during therapy. There's some research looking at different medications. There's something called D-cycloserine, which is actually a drug for tuberculosis, that if you have taken before exposure therapy, in some cases seems to enhance make it work more quickly. There's other, you know, people looking at other drugs that also act as sort of learning enhancers for therapy. Two things that are, you know, other therapies are actually looking to, you know, what's the exciting thing is that because of advances in neuroimaging, researchers have much more knowledge now about what actually anxiety looks like in the brain. And so they're developing new treatments to actually target that underlying neurobiology of anxiety. So, for example, one of the things, and also the kind of cognitive signatures of anxiety, for example, anxious people see more peril in the world. They actually have something called an attention bias to threat, where they, you know, if I, so say, say I'm giving a speech, I'm much more likely to notice one person frowning a little bit, and I'm much more likely to point my attention to that person as opposed to the many other people who are smiling or giving me positive feedback. So what, there's actually a treatment called attention bias modification, and what it does is it trains people with anxiety disorders to attend to neutral things in their environment and not so much to potential threatening images in the environment.
Fascinating. Well, Julie in Black River Falls, I'm not sure if we answered your question, but go ahead.
Hi, I have a son who is 21 years old who has been exhibiting signs of anxiety since he was very young. He threw up every single first day of school, going through school and separation anxiety. Interestingly enough, he has a fear of people who are in costumes. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the attention to negative things, I mean, he will perceive negative things going around him that other people don't recognize. He's a college student. He has just started a new job, and I think that he could be close to be having an anxiety attack about this new situation and this change. He hasn't adapted well to changes that causes him anxiety, and we just don't know where to start about whether we go to the general practitioner, about how to get a recommendation for a therapist or a psychiatrist for the cognitive therapy. Where do we start? Because he wants to get help now.
There are a couple really good resources. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America actually has a website, and you can find practitioners that through that. Also, there's an Association for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies. It's an association of therapists that are trained in CBT. Because unfortunately, what can happen is oftentimes you really have to ask for the particular kind of treatment because to make sure you're sort of getting evidence-based treatment, because there's all sorts of modalities out there. There's all sorts of practitioners that practice different ways, and to really ask for CBT by name.
So ask for the cognitive behavioral therapy.
There are other things that also work as well. That's the therapy that has the most evidence behind it, and I usually recommend that. Obviously people talk to their therapist, but to start with that.
Julie, good luck to you and your son. Let me go to Nikki in East Troy. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Thank you for having my call. My question or comment concern was, how do you know when to seek help? Because I feel like I've been dealing with anxiety now for a while, and I just kind of put it down as depression because I've been dealing with that since I was a kid, I feel. And it's just gotten worse as I've gotten older.
So yeah, how do you determine? Hey, I'm dealing with something that's beyond normal anxiety, Andrea.
I think if it's impairing your life, if it's affecting your ability to do the work that you love, to be really present in your relationships. I mean, that to me was a big red flag too. Is when I find, because I think anxiety can often feel like an isolation chamber. It can separate us from those that we love and prevent us from enjoying the moment. So if you're feeling those things, I think that's definitely it's time to seek some help.
Good luck, Nikki. We are talking with Andrea Peterson. She is the author of On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for her, you can also share a personal experience or story. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Andrea Peterson, who is a contributing writer at the Wall Street Journal. She writes and reports on health and psychology and neuroscience, and she is the author of On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. And we are talking about the issue of anxiety in the U.S. Some 40 million Americans suffer from anxiety disorders. Our guest is among them. She writes about her own personal experience with anxiety and what's out there to help and what's on the horizon, and we welcome your questions. Let me share Chris from Ashland, who emails, I have struggled with anxiety my entire life. It got to the point it started to change my life. I wasn't able to function normally. I was put on prescription meds, which I became addicted to. They began to ruin my life. Thankfully, with the help of my loved ones, I was able to get off the pills and handle my anxiety by reading calming books and by exercising. After years of struggling, I finally know how to manage my anxiety. Well, a couple of different things here. First off, right. Some of those meds are addictive.
Well, I'm guessing that the writer is probably talking about benzodiazepines. These are medications like Valium, Xanax, Klonopin that, they're pretty miraculous in that they do can ease anxiety immediately. I mean, if I take I carry Klonopin with me, and if I'm having a panic attack and I take one, it can actually derail a panic attack. But as the writer mentioned, the issue with benzodiazepines is they do have a potential for addiction and abuse. I take my benzodiazepine very rarely, but there are some people who are prescribed them for chronic use, and that is very controversial sort of in the field. But there are online support groups for people who are undergoing a benzodiazepine withdrawal, and some of the stories on there are incredibly heart-wrenching, and it does seem like the treatment can sometimes be worse than the disease itself.
What about handling anxiety by exercising or reading calming books, and I presume maybe some other things?
Yes, I personally, when my anxiety is incredibly is really heightened, I need to go to cognitive behavioral therapy and medication. But even in years that are a little easier, things like exercise has been shown to help mitigate anxiety symptoms. Proper sleep is very important as well. There's a direct link between insufficient sleep and sleep problems and anxiety. So that's important as well. Mindfulness is actually there's more and more research really showing the benefit of meditation, yoga, mindfulness as a treatment for anxiety as well. And it makes sense if you think about it, because anxiety is really a future-oriented state. The definition that I really always come back to is from a neuroscientist at the National Institute of Mental Health, who told me that anxiety is the anticipation of pain. It could be physical pain, it could be emotional pain. And so mindfulness, it's sort of an antidote to that, because anything that kind of grounds you in the present moment is antithetical to, to this future-oriented state that anxiety is. So for me, actually, things like baking, I love to, that's something that really grounds me in the present moment. Even cleaning toilets, honestly, can be therapeutic.
Yeah, I can imagine. I know cleaning cupboards and clutter and all that.
Yeah,
can be, it's you feel good after it's over too.
And you're right, and you get a clean house at the same time. So,
Donna,
I'm not saying for treating an acute anxiety disorder that baking is not gonna be enough. But those little things that one can do sort of every day. For me to sort of, since I know I'm prone to anxiety, since I know a relapse is always a possibility, these are the things I can do to sort of keep myself on an even keel.
And Andrew, I suppose it's all individual, but for you, for example, how long might you go in between and a panic attack? Do you go years or months or weeks?
It can be. It's probably been a few years since I've had a full blown panic attack, out of the blue, which is, knock on wood now, but,
Let's go to Donna in the Chicago area. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
I have to tell you, I'm having a little anxiety about sharing my anxiety.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't worry. We're all friends here.
Oh, I know. I am a veteran. I had a TBI while I was in the service, and which resulted in a migraine disorder that exploded into full-blown panic attacks every time I would see flashing lights or get the auras that a migraine is coming on. And I'm actually on my way to my therapist right now. I'm just pulling in the parking lot, so this is very
good for you.
But I also, it does impact my life so much that I've just given notice at a job. I've been there for 3 years. I'm a manager, and it was almost like anxiety colliding. My anxiety shuts me down, and my direct supervisor has an anxiety that causes her to lash out at people. So it was like, it was, Xanax was becoming a maintenance drug for me. So I'm leaving that job and going to a part-time job where I won't be managing people. But, so it's a struggle. It's been a struggle for me for 30 years now. And, it's only been in the past couple years that I've, realized that it's not just me, dealing with things poorly. It's a major anxiety disorder. So.
Yeah. And Donna, I hopefully maybe taking your less stressful job without a boss who's also got an anxiety issue might be helpful. And what do you think, Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, it's anxiety can definitely affect work. And I, you know, as long, if you're getting the appropriate treatment and if you're finding that you need to sort of ease stress in your life and this is the way to do it, then it sounds like you're making the right choice for yourself. I mean, how I've handled, I mean, I think everyone tries to sort of has to kind of manage the stressors in their life, you know, on an individual basis. And I've always clued in a couple close work friends about my anxiety. I didn't tell my bosses because I was worried about how that would impact my career, but getting that sort of support at work can be really important.
Good luck to you, Donna. I was looking to see if Andrea, you had a stop in Chicago for your book tour. I thought I saw it, but I don't see one now.
It looks like in the fall. I'll be in Chicago. I'm not sure exactly where yet, but I'll definitely be posting on Twitter and Facebook.
Check that out. Let's go to Anna in Milwaukee. Hi, Anna.
Good morning. Thanks for having my call. I suffer from anxiety and depression as well, and they kind of go back and forth as far as which one is manifesting itself at any given time. But I do medication therapy and a combination of Wellbutrin and escitalopram. I can't think of the brand for that right now. And I'm kind of a walking commercial for clonopine. Like, I don't leave home without it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the opposite of what that other gentleman was saying, where he became addicted. Mine manifests itself in the form of being very fearful of abandonment. Love.
Oh, no, I think...
Are there ways with her?
Yeah, we lost Anna's connection on her phone. Well, and I've heard of this. In fact, I have a loved one who has this same anxiety, a fear of abandonment and disappointing others. Have you heard of that, Andrea?
Definitely. And I think, I mean, the issue, anxiety definitely can affect relationships. And, you know, I think, as I mentioned before, I mean, it can, what researchers have found is that anxiety can tax relationships, and relationships can also, you know, and also troubles in relationships can fuel anxiety. So it can often be sort of a chicken and the egg, you know, quandary. And, you know, I think also what can be difficult for people who don't struggle with anxiety is it can be hard to understand. And that was actually part of the reason that I wrote this book, was to try to, you know, give insight for not just and for not just people who struggle with anxiety, but also people who love them. That you know, sometimes we can't just relax, or we can't just let it go. That it's, or if we take a walk or just take some deep breaths, it's not enough.
Yeah, saying calm down is not going to cut it.
Not usually that helpful, no.
Yeah. You know, we have lots more of feedback here. Jen on Facebook says, unfortunately, my son is the fifth generation of my family with anxiety. I know for sure all the way back to my great-grandma, we had anxiety that needed medication and or hospitalization. I'm glad we caught my son's anxiety disorder early. There is no need to suffer. Talk some about that, maybe parents and children and anxiety.
Yes, I mean, there's actually some really fascinating work being done to prevent anxiety disorders in children who are at risk. And that is, there's people that are working with, I think, as I mentioned before, these children who are behaviorally inhibited, who have a very socially reticent temperament that makes them at much higher risk for anxiety disorders. There's some intervention programs. I actually visited one at the University of Maryland that is both teaching these kids social skills, because oftentimes anxiety can impede sort of social development. And so kids are taught, you know, how to ask another child to play and how to identify their emotions. And also at the same time, kind of, you know, doing sort of mini cognitive behavioral therapy, to help kids approach the situations that they are already starting to fear. And that those have seen some really pretty, you know, some pretty great results. Also teaching the parents, because oftentimes what parents will do of anxious children will do is that they will start to become overprotective and more controlling. And we do it out of a place of love. No one wants to see their child in distress. But by allowing the child to skip the birthday party or to stop taking ballet lessons or whatever it is, or even speaking for the child, if a child is afraid to, you know, it doesn't like to talk to other people, I mean, that actually is reinforcing the anxiety. It's telling the child, like, you you aren't capable of doing this. And so the therapy, the treatment programs and the prevention programs also teach the parents to sort of avoid or ignore anxious behavior and praise brave behavior and teach them to sort of set up what they call bravery practice with their own kids. So I'm very excited about these programs because, you know, I have a daughter. She clearly has a genetic predisposition to anxiety. And so I'm trying to incorporate some of these strategies in my life and with her. And so I think that's wonderful that the caller has seen some good results about intervening early.
We have less than a minute to go, and we really did cover a lot of territory. This has been really eye-opening. What is your maybe final message or takeaway for our listeners?
I want to just encourage people to impress upon people that anxiety is not a moral failing. It does not mean you're weak. It is an illness like any other illness.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. Andrea Peterson is the author of On Edge, a journey through anxiety. She's a contributing writer at the Wall Street Journal. And we will post some of the resources she mentioned on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Brianne Chasseau for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.